brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
SoftRep.com, on time, on target. My name, I think most of you know by now, is Ian Scotto. I am the producer and one of the hosts on this great show for the past several years. But as you're hearing this, I am currently in Pittsburgh visiting my family, visiting my grandma and my uncle who live there. So I was rattling my brain with what I could put on for this show while I'm away. And I was thinking, we just had Dan Gordon on, who's a great fiction author, but most known as a Hollywood screenwriter and IDF veteran. Loved that interview. But we've had some really incredible fiction authors in studio in the past year. And I think some of you have heard those, some of you haven't, because there's always new people listening. So I figured I'd highlight some of those great authors that we had on in studio. So we'll get right into that. But first, I want to let you guys know there's only one club out there with gear handpicked by Special Operations military veterans from several branches. And that, of course, is Crate Club. Past items in our crates have been Emerson Knives, a Black Hawk Industrials medical pouch, and cool stuff like a custom playing card set from an exclusive photo shoot we did with some hot models with guns. We have different tiers of membership depending on how prepared you want to be. And gift options are available as well. You check that all out at crateclub.us. Check it out right now. Once again, that's crateclub.us. We'd love to have you join. And for your dog owners, check this out. You're going to love it. We've just partnered with Kuna. They have a team of trained canine handlers picking out a box for your dog each month of healthy treats and training aids. It's custom built for your dog's size and age as well. The products are U.S. sourced, all natural, and not only promote a healthy diet, but also promote being active with your dog. So whether we're talking a pit bull or a chihuahua, this is just what you're looking for. You could see all of that at kuna.dog. That's kuna.dog. It's efficient for you, and your dog will appreciate it as well, of course. That's spelled CUNA.DOG. First box people are loving, and the second box is on its way. Also, as a reminder for those of you who are listening for a limited time, you could receive a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel, our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country, everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership. Only $4.99 a month. The app is available now. That's the Spec Ops channel. Check it out, specopschannel.com. Getting into the content of this episode, as I said, we've had some great fiction, military fiction writers on this past year, and I wanted you guys to hear some of that. So who's a bigger name in that field than Brad Thor? Check this out. This is Brad Thor talking about the process that he went through of fulfilling his dream to become an author.
Give people an idea of who Brad Thor is. I know you're born in Chicago, went to USC, studied creative writing, but
Dad's a Marine.
Can you tell us, like, give us the childhood story up until, like, what made you want to be get into creative writing and
Yeah, so the quick on it is my grandfather was the first one born in this country, went to work at the phone company, played trombone on the weekends in Capone speakeasies to make more money for the family. My old man wanted to escape the South Side of Chicago, wanted to be a Marine, became a Marine, went to Pendleton, all that stuff, and he became a Marine, and then, you know, Subic Bay and stuff like that. So he was over in that part of the world and got to go to college on the GI Bill. First person in our family to go to college and ended up going into real estate development. He was doing a bunch in Southern California. So every time we see Die Hard, like Nakatomi Plaza, my dad helped build Nakatomi Plaza. It's kind of our fun family claim to fame. But he did a lot of stuff in Southern California, and he met a lot of USC grads. And my dad said they were like the Cosa Nostra. So if you and I were applying for a job and you went to USC, I went to USC, but Brandon went to UCLA, it's like, if you're hiring, you're hiring me because I went to SC. That was the legend. So he wanted us to go to school there. I had actually applied to go to Mizzou, and I wanted to go into the journalism program. But the great Santini was footing the bill, so he gets to decide, you know.
Great book.
Yeah, great book. Yeah. I got to meet Pat before he passed. Really interesting guy. So went to USC, was a business administration major, and I hated it. I could not stand it. And I got about 2 years into it, and I was like, this sucks. And I was in an economics class. It was February. This guy was Pakistani, I think, or something like this. And he came out on the stage in the auditorium where our econ class was, and he was trembling. He was so excited. He had this great thing where Valentine's Day is coming, so I'm going to do something relevant for my class. All right, you're a middle manager in a flower store chain. You've got X amount of orders, only so many vases. And I closed my books. I was like, fuck this. I'm like, and my friends are like, what's going on? And I said, I'd rather take a bullet between the eyes than be a middle manager in a flower store chain for the rest of my life. They're like, Thor, it's just an exercise. You don't have to go into, I'm like, no, it's a whole big thing. I got some issues and I'm out. And I hit a couple of bars for a couple of days and was feeling sorry for myself. Didn't know I was aimless. And I thought, you know, what a shitbag am I? Yeah. My dad busts his ass, goes through the Marine Corps, goes to school on the GI Bill. I'm getting a free ride. I had to work while I was in college, yeah. But my old man was picking up the tab. I was really fortunate. My dad's thing was, you know, I want you to go to school, you know, marry a good wife and go right into private enterprise, capitalism. My dad's a big capitalist. And he said, no law enforcement, no military. What ends up happening, I end up, long story short, I end up becoming an author. All my friends are military. All my friends are cops. Went through the police academy back in Illinois to be a reserve patrol officer. Never got called up, never did anything, but went through the academy in a small village north of Chicago with some great warriors that were thrilled to open up their reserve program to somebody like me, really lucked out to be in my 40s and go through the police academy. It was a cool experience, worked its way into the books. But so I just said no more business administration at USC. And I went to the career counseling office and took something called the Strong-Campbell personality test. And it showed that I scored off the charts for writing and publishing. And all it does is match up your interests. Here are people that like what they do and their interests align with yours. Doesn't mean you're going to be good at it. And so I switched. I started taking creative writing classes at USC. Didn't change the major, though. But eventually the great Santini found me out. I got a blanket. I got his version of a blanket party when I was home for Christmas one year. And then we kissed and made up. And a lot of bond traders in the late 80s, early 90s were leaving New York and going to L.A. to work on movies and to do completion bonds and financing for films. So he thought I was kind of avant-garde and ahead of the curve. And I saved money and I went overseas. Friends of mine had an extra room in Paris. First American, by the way, proud to say this, I'm the first American to ever go to Paris to write a novel. Nice. Had never been done before until I did it. So nice. Kind of neat. I got three chapters into it and I said, oh my God, you know, I'd rather suck start a Glock than to do this. It's the most solitary career in the world. And I shipped my laptop back home and traveled in Europe with the money I'd saved leasing apartments in LA. But what it was is I was afraid of failure. What happens if the book sucks? Yeah. What if I can't sell it? What if nobody likes it, wants to read it? And I had that little voice in the back of my head saying, don't risk the embarrassment. And a long time ago, I took the United Negro College Fund slogan, a mind is a terrible thing to waste, and shortened it to a mind is a terrible thing, period. So I traveled with money, backpack, until I ran out of money. I worked in a bar in Greece, and I saw all these other kids traveling with backpacks. And I said, you know what? Travel makes me a better American because I'm seeing the world and I know how good we have it. And I want to go home and encourage young people, 18 to 34, to start traveling now. Don't wait till you're retired. You're going to realize how flipping lucky you are. So I pitched public television. I was like, hey, I got this idea for a show. And the great Santini is so cool. He's like, listen, everybody is working on the come in LA. Everybody's looking for their next gig. They're all freelancers. What you need to do to take the focus off the fact you've never done anything before is put together a team and say to this team, cameraman, director, if I can get this finance, will you work with me? And then use their resumes. So what have you done before? Well, let me tell you about our director. He's a two-time Emmy Award-winning director. So my dad's expression was, nobody's born with a beard. So I used these guys as the beard. I launched a show, did two seasons of a travel show called Traveling Light. I was the host, the writer, the producer. And then on my honeymoon, my wife said, what would you regret on your deathbed never having done? Good question to ask before you're married. Maybe not one you want to leave until the good for both parties to ask. But I said, writing a book and getting it published. And she said, cool. When we're home, you need to start taking 2 hours a day.
That's a great partner.
Make that happen. Nice. Fantastic. Yeah, I wouldn't have taken the leap without her.
How old then when you published your first novel?
So first novel was 2002. So I had to be about 30, 31.
That's pretty cool then, because I feel like a lot of people who are 30, they feel like they're stuck at some job they started in their 20s. I have friends like that who work restaurants and have bigger dreams, and they feel like, well, I'm kind of stuck doing this. You're not stuck doing anything. You could have published your first novel at 40.
Sure.
And I think that's an inspiring thing that people need to, if they have a dream, go for it.
It amazes me how many people are, and I, you know, I love New York City. It's a great city, but I see every day people who are absolutely fucking miserable in their current role, and they just won't make a change. It's like, oh, they're making okay money, but they just won't do it. And it, to me, the scary thing is not to live life, you know, and pursue that dream.
Not take a risk.
I try and put it and have these talks with my own kids. It's like, look, I'll get you through college and then you're on your own. But your job is to reach as high as you can and know that, you know, I'll always be here to catch you if you fall, but you know, you need to go out there and do what you genuinely love to do, period.
What's that you're not going to regret? And I've done a lot of stupid things, but you're not going to regret the things you did. It's the things you didn't do. That's what you're going to regret when you're sitting there in the rocking chair and you're lucky enough to make it to your 90s. You know, I don't want to do that. And but with my wife, so for me, I don't have man cards on the table. I've now told my wife my deepest, darkest secret. How can I say, oh, but you married a coward?
Yeah.
I mean, so I wasn't going to do that. So I had that kind of wind at my back and that in my sails. And she's like, I'll keep the world at bay.
That's great.
You tell me those 2 hours, and 2 hours turned to three, turned to four. There's a lot of stuff for a longer conversation over a lot more whiskey, a lot of other interesting pieces that fell in place. I met somebody from Simon & Schuster on that trip. We shared an overnight train compartment. She led to my editor. The idea, we walked into an empty cafe. We were waiting for food. I looked over. There's an English language newspaper. I found the idea for my first book in there.
Wow.
A true life story about a Swiss intelligence officer who embezzled all this money from the Swiss army and was training his own shadow militia high in the Alps with high-tech weapons from his own private arsenal. Clinton was taking Chelsea for her birthday skiing in Park City, which is where we were leaving. I knew some Secret Service guys.
And you grew up, you spent 8 years in Park City.
We did. Yeah. My wife was a doc for the ski team, which is why my guy, Scott Harvath from Coronado, was a freestyle skier. His dad was a SEAL, and he didn't want any part of that world until his dad died and then realized, you know what? I did this to piss my dad off. I was independent, but now I want to kind of follow in his footsteps. So there's a lot of personal things. And I think Jack Ryan was Clancy's alter ego. Yeah. I think Bond was Fleming's, because Fleming was he hated women, you know, and he was just cold towards him and stuff. So I think Harvath is my alter ego. It's my way. And I made this joke with George Peterson. I said, you know, George, you're so much smarter than I am because I wanted to be a SEAL and an author. You wanted to be an author and a SEAL. You did it in the right direction. You know, you were a SEAL first, then you became an author. I'm an author. I can't, there's no way I would survive through BUDS. There's
you're
no way
I even make it.
I'm too
point.
Old. Yeah. I mean, I could get the best forger in the world, but I'm not going to fool anybody. So I joked with George. I said, you did it in the right order. You know, so, but I had a meeting with Mouse McCoy, who was the director of Act of Valor. Worked with all the SEALs in his film and all that kind of stuff. And one thing he said to me, and I took it to heart, is he said, you know, Brad, you and I didn't serve, but we are kind of in this pop culture, and it is incumbent upon us to protect that SEAL brand, to protect the special. We don't own that brand, and we're not entitled to it. But if we are going to be working in that world of introducing, you know, these heroic people, it is incumbent upon us to make sure that we don't tarnish that brand, and we do everything we can to burnish it. And one of the things I'm most proud of is young men and women that go into service because they said they've read my books. Oh, I joined the Navy or I joined the FBI or whatever it is. And I'm really, really proud of that. So,
yeah, that's pretty cool.
That was the great Brad Thor. I think we'll have him back on soon. But if you want to check out that full episode, that's episode 260. And for those who don't know, I know some of you listening on Apple Podcasts or even SoundCloud are like, where are these old episodes? Where's episodes one through whatever? Those are all up at sofrep.com/radio. We have the full archive available there. Did that for several reasons, actually. You know, we've changed the format a few times throughout the years and made the shows ad-free and things like that and had old ads. So anyway, you can check those all out. It's at sofrep.com/radio if you want to go back to episode 260 and listen to that full interview with Brad Thor. Next up here is General Tony Tata, who writes as AJ Tata. And on this clip, he talks about what inspired him to write and who inspired the Delta Force protagonist of his novels, Jake Mohegan. Here's what I was wondering is, so you're a former Army Brigadier General, of course. Right. Yeah. Was Jake Mohegan, I know he's a Delta Force captain. Was he inspired by someone in your own life and your own experiences?
That's another great question, because my protagonists are inspired by the men and women I served with, the great Americans. I had this young soldier. I was probably in the toughest firefight of my life in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan. And this young man, a staff sergeant, he was then a sergeant, gets shot through the arm as we're getting off the helicopter. And it just, everything unloads on us. And Sergeant William Vile ties off his own tourniquet. And he's a mortar ballistic computer guy. So he's the key guy. He's got the radio in his ear. And, you know, I'm a general. The captain comes up to me, grabs me by the body armor, and like a coach grabs a quarterback by the face mask and says, I don't need a dead general in my base camp. And I said, I will try to make you happy. Nice. And so I got down there in the command post and watched Vile. He was bleeding. He had blood dripping on the floor. I tapped a medic. You know, I knew the captain, the company commander. I was coming to see him just to, you know, do some battlefield circulation up there on the PAC border. And the medic says, sir, you don't know Sergeant Vile. He's not going to let me work on him. I said, well, he's going into shock, you know, and he's over there shaking. And then Vile says to the medic, as the medic comes over there, he says, get the away from me. That's not exactly what he said, but and then you get first run. You know, I call in, we get a couple of B-1 bombers or B-2 bombers over us. We get some A-10s. So the general does his job, right? Gets the air power in there, and there's RPGs smoking through the sky, bullets coming through the roof like hail in a summer storm, and Vile is just sitting there, cool as a cucumber at a picnic table. And this little dingy, dusty Korangal outpost, and first round goes downrange, shuts down the machine gun. He gets a direct hit. He pushes across the table his mortar ballistic computer to his private that was his assistant, and he turns to the medic and says, now you can work on me.
Nice.
That's the kind of guy I want Mohegan to be.
Yeah.
So it's those kinds of qualities that I look for, that sort of selfless service. You know, you're serving your buddies and that kind of thing. We medevaced him out. I got to pin on his Purple Heart before. It was 2 months in Walter Reed, and he had to have reconstruction on his arm.
It's, you know, working in the special ops community, it's a little different. But before I was a SEAL, I was an air crew search and rescue swimmer in H-60s and a sonar operator.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a situation where we were flying at, and this has to do with guys like that. We had this guy, Kennedy, who was one of the pilots in our squadron that was kind of like chubby, you know, nerdy kind of pilot, but very smart. And right. Everybody loved him. But he was just kind of like this goofy, kind of nerdy helicopter pilot. And we were flying on night vision, and we had to refuel on a destroyer to get back to the aircraft carrier.
Right.
We come off NODS and probably didn't give enough time to dark adapt. And he was a helicopter commander, but he was not the pilot in command.
Right.
The other pilot, Bennett, had the controls. He said, okay, I'm slowing down. You can get the door open, because I would spot the deck. And we flew. I opened the door, the cabin door, had the gunner's belt on, and I looked to where the VASI lights of the destroyer were, the lineup lights, uh-huh. to kind of spot, and I didn't see any lights. I'm like, that's very odd. And I looked down, and we hit the water, like at slow speed, thank God. Like the pilot, Bennett had got vertigo and literally flew us into the water. And I thought, I'm fucking dead. Because the water's coming in the cabin now, and I'm screaming for altitude, and Bennett loses his shit. Yeah. Like, loses it.
Right.
And here's this, like, Kennedy, and you just never know who's got it until they're put in that tested by fire.
Yeah.
He took controls and literally
powered up,
landed us safely on the deck, like, and pulled this helicopter out of water. The maintenance chief didn't
believe
us.
That was taken on water. And yeah, so now it weighs, you know, 1,000 pounds more than it weighed
before. Yeah, we would have been dead if it had been high speed, but we hit slow.
Yeah.
And the maintenance chief didn't believe us till they removed the tail section, like 10 gallons of seawater.
Yeah, you think of the stones that, you know, some of those guys have.
But you just don't know what's on the inside is my point. And you get guys like Vile.
Yeah,
Vile tying off his own freaking tourniquet.
Yeah, on one knee under machine gun fire. And then, you know, he's like John Wayne running in there. It was unbelievable. And so that's the kind of guy that you want.
Great.
That's who we all love, right? That's who the listeners and the readers love. They know that heroism is out there, and so they want to see it and feel it.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I'm interested to see how you started writing, because for me it was mostly therapeutic at first. But
Brandon, you and I are exactly the same. I've written most of my life because I always wanted to write, but it intensified when I was a paratrooper in the 82nd and just constant deployments, constant motion. And I said, I need an outlet.
Yeah.
And so I started seriously writing. I had Tom Clancy come to see my battalion when I was in the commander in the 82nd, and he's chain smoking around a bunch of paratroopers and parachutes. You know, I'm like, Mr. Clancy, you know, we don't like fire near our parachute, but anyway. And he said, look, Tata, if you want to be a writer, then write. And so I started.
Started
writing, it's been this is book 7, Besieged is book 7, book 3 in the series, and just absolutely love it because it is therapeutic. And I'll tell you, Brandon, I went to do for my first book. You remember that comedy show Fraser Crane or something?
Yeah.
It was a nighttime psychiatrist or whatever. I did a show like that in L.A. It was a nighttime psychiatrist, and he would take calls, and it was an hour-long show. And he wanted to talk about post-traumatic stress. So before I did it, I called the chief of Army Nursing, Rhonda Corbett, who had been shot down behind enemy lines in Desert Storm and taken prisoner by the Iraqis. And now she was one star in charge of Army Nursing. And she said, Tony, you are doing what we are trying to get everybody to do, and that is to find that outlet, that artistic outlet. Okay. And so you and I found that of our own accord. And that's kind of what I talked to this psychiatrist about, is that we don't want our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines so brittle that when they lose their best friend, they crumble.
Yeah.
They've got to have that avenue to go burn it off, whether it's playing the guitar, writing, or whatever.
That was AJ Tata back on episode 253. If you want to check out that full episode, once again, that's in the archives as well, softrep.com/radio. Getting into this next fiction writer, who is a former Marine, Anderson Harp. Anderson Harp talks about the background of his books with North Korea and how these are books that he wrote several years back but really appeal to the audience today because we're having the same ongoing issues with North Korea. And if you read these, you'll see they're very eye-opening, and Anderson's military background really works for what he's writing. So check it out. He talks about that, as well as a really crazy Pentagon story involving the death of a hero he knew, and he died on 9/11 in the Pentagon. So let's get right into that with Anderson Harp.
Actually, I served in the Pentagon, and when I was in the Pentagon, I was started to wonder about the North Korean situation. And then I started wanting to do the fiction aspect of it. But the premise of the book is that that Kim had one scientist that was a world expert in nanotechnology or miniaturization, particularly miniaturization of a nuclear weapon. Mm. And so they of course, have continued to improve on their delivery systems. Now the ICBM is being reported. And then the question was, you know, as I was actually interviewed by the BBC many years ago, and I said always the problem with North Korea is that they have a missile that they're developing that could get here, so to speak, but that they had a nuclear weapon that was probably the size of a small Volkswagen. So the question became, when those two lines cross, when they develop a weapon that could be carried on top of an ICBM. And they're getting really, really close to that right now. There's varying viewpoints about that. But the premise of the book was that they had one scientist that was able to put that together for them to miniaturize their weapon and improve the delivery system. And what's really been fascinating about this is, although this is written in fiction and is fiction, is that the public intelligence is reporting that Kim has three key people that are very close to him now that are specialists in the weapon delivery system, the ICBM, and the miniaturization of the nuclear weapon. And I should say one of the things that's so scary about that is Kim right now is reported to be a guesstimate, because they really don't know because how secretive that world is. He's reported to be about 37 years old. Well, his father died when he was about 67 years old. So we're talking about a guy that is on a path to develop weapons, and he's got another 30 years plus to do exactly that. So anyway, so I think the book's a good read. It's about a special operations, about my character having to go into North Korea. He knew this scientist from a former life. He could identify this scientist out of a crowd of doppelgangers, as they call, or, you know, that's another thing they do, and that he could pick that person out. And then there's some betrayal, and there's some crisscross, and I think it's a fun read.
Yeah, the cool thing that I was saying is, since this is technically the first of the series, but it's the new release, once people read it, they could then pick up those right there, Born of War and Retribution.
Yes.
And they have three books in the series that they could check out if they're into your work.
Yeah, yeah, because the protagonist is a Marine that he sort of left the Marine Corps. Like us, never leave the Marine Corps, but we're not wearing the uniform
still
anymore.
Still always with us.
But anyway, that he's called in for under this book for a specific mission, and then that sets him on a life's journey, so to speak, of doing other missions. So one in Pakistan and Hindu Kush, and another one in Somalia. So
very cool. So let's get into the Marine stuff. You were telling me about your background in the Marines.
Yeah.
You were also telling me about some awesome Pentagon 9/11 stories that are pretty captivating when you got here. So it'd be cool to get into some of those and maybe some crossover between what Jason's done in the Marines and what you got to do with your time in the Marines.
Yeah, nothing in comparison to him. I mean, he had 30 years in the Corps. He definitely made an impact.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, 4 years active duty and then 26 reserve.
Yes, sir.
And it was mobilized in the reserve for enduring freedom. On the active duty side, it was interesting. It was post-Vietnam, and there was actually a colonel at the time that was the what called the G3 of 1st MAR Div, who has gone on to be a well-known person. At the time, he was Colonel O.K. Steele. And I think he went on to be a CG of 2nd MAR Div. Anyway, he went out to the division, said, anybody know skiing in cold weather? And I was pulled out of the division, out of the 11th Marines Artillery, to open up Bridgeport with several other, with a training group that actually became now the more notorious, well-known Red Hats, I think is what they,
yes, sir,
what they call them now.
Still called Red Hats.
Yeah, we were sort of pre-Red Hat.
Yeah.
We were old hat.
Yeah.
But we went into Bridgeport and basically unlocked all the things and stayed in Quonset huts when we weren't up on the mountain. And then we would bring battalions up from 1st MAR Div.
Yes, sir.
Up to a winter cycle. And then also we did a summer cycle. The rock cycle.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and did that. And then was sent by the Marines to Fort Greely, Alaska, which is the Army's Arctic Survival School. You know, we're so small, there are very few specialty schools that we
have our own.
Yeah, we
piggyback a lot. We definitely piggyback a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So Fort Greeley at the time, now I think it's Fort Drum, 10th Mountaineer is their cold weather thing. But Fort Greeley, Alaska was it, and that was 44 degrees below zero on a typical day that we were there, and then came back. And then in my later career as a reservist and also mobilized for Enduring Freedom, I served various commands. I did a lot in Korea with the exercise that's going on right now.
I think it's what is the main program in Korea called? I have a brain fart. It's like a rock package. It's a similar, where you do the rappelling, the assaulting, the.
And then we also did the big operation that's getting ready to kick off right now. I think where you simulate if Southern Korea were attacked. Mm-hmm. And then I was moved over to the Pentagon, where I worked with the Assistant Secretary of Defense Reserve Affairs Office. And the interesting story about that, Ian, that I was telling you about was that I left there just before September the 11th, about a year before September the 11th, to go out to Hawaii, where at the time the Marine Corps, the issues were so small that Marine Forces Pacific, I think, was dual-hatted as Marine mm-hmm. Forces CENTCOM. So I think PAC...
I see where you go.
Yeah, PAC actually had the duties of CENTCOM. And, of course, then CENTCOM took on its own scale now, major scale, and mm-hmm. got its own man. But we were part of the buildup for the invasion of Afghanistan, overseer for Afghanistan. But anyway, back at the Pentagon, one of the interesting stories about that was that while we were in those offices, one side of the walls were all sheets of plywood. And behind those sheets of plywood, they were taking the Pentagon one pie shape at a time. Mm. And they were gutting it and rebuilding it. And they took it right down to the cement pillars. Anyway, I left there, and then after that, September 11th occurred. So when I came to that job, I was replacing a Navy captain by the name of Chick Burlingame. And Chick was a fighter pilot. I can't remember exactly what Chick flew. But he came in as I left. I mean, he came out, left as I came in. I remember the going away party and everything. Anyway, September 11th occurred and the world stopped. And then about a month later, I called back to my old office, not sure what I was going to get. And I got one of the secretaries and I said, "Oh, thank God, what's going on?" She said, "Well, about a month before September 11th, we were moved to the other side of the Pentagon. But did you hear about Chick Burlingame?" I said, "No." Well, our offices at the E-ring looked out over the helicopter pad, which is where mm-hmm. the jet came in. Chick left the reserves, made his years in, and then returned to his job as a commercial pilot. And he was the pilot on the airplane that flew into the Pentagon.
Wow.
So he actually was killed in a place where he worked for 3 years.
I'm pretty sure he was, no offense, but I'm pretty sure he was killed before they impacted. Because I'm sure he wouldn't have put up for that. So
yeah, I think that's what the theory was. Then they had the box.
They took cutters. Yeah, they took flight lessons and all that stuff too. I think they were taking lessons in Florida. They found out. So I'm pretty sure, especially coming from his background, he ain't tolerating that crap. Yeah, he ain't go down quietly. I'm pretty sure.
Anyway, he was what we call a gray area reservist, which meant that to vest as a reservist, you have to be age 60. And then when you vest at age 60, you are vested as a full retiree. And one of the things you're vested at 60 is internment in Arlington. Mm. And his widow had to apply for Congress to give him a waiver, and I understand that he was interred at Arlington.
Good.
But anyway, so that was a seated history, so to speak.
Great clip with Anderson. Very tragic story, though. And if you want to hear that interview in its entirety, that was back on episode 276. So look that up, and you'll find it, episode 276 with Anderson Harp. Really appreciate you guys checking out this special. We'll be back on Wednesday with a new episode. And as always, you can follow myself on Twitter at Ian Scotto. You can follow Jack, who's usually here with me, on Twitter at Jack Murphy RGR. Let us know what you think. Send over your emails to softrep.radio@softrep.com. Most importantly, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I can't stress it enough. When you write a review for us, it really helps us out. We have a lot of competition in that government category. And if you want us to keep doing this free, as we've been doing, that's really the way that you could help us out. So write up a review on there, and we'll keep having great guests on, like AJ Tata, Anderson Harp, and Brad Thor that you want to hear. I think Brad Thor will be back on in studio soon. And yeah, that's about it. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at SoftRep Radio, and I'm out.
You've been listening to SoftRep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. For all of the great content from our veteran journalists, join us and become a Team Room member today at softrep.com. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at SoftRep Radio. And be sure to also check out the Power of Thought podcast, hosted by Hurricane Group CEO and Navy SEAL sniper instructor, Brandon Webb.